Now, Extension 720 with your host, Milt Rosenberg. Milt?
And, as always, more than a pleasure, an absolute delight to welcome to the program Mortimer J. Adler, late, rather a long time ago, of the University of Chicago, and presently, as he has for some time, director of the Institute for Philosophical Research here in Chicago, one of the great intellectual treasures of this nation, and author of so much of such great interest, but most recently, and I hold it in my hand, a new book titled The Angels and Us, in fact, not yet officially published at this moment, but officially to be published tomorrow. Is that right?
I think so.
The publishers Macmillan and Company, and in Macmillan in London as well. I know a way to get a rise out of you and to get you to break your usual gentlemanly calm and decency and goodwill. I can ask you, is this the book that finally tells us, Dr. Adler, how many angels might dance on the head of a pin?
I will try to contain myself. First of all, the question was never asked by any respectable theologian in the Middle Ages.
Actually, it's often quoted as an example of the mindless and pointless preoccupations of Christian theologians of the Middle Ages.
Precisely. It is, like many of the modern myths about the Middle Ages, made up for that purpose and for that purpose alone. Angels, in the first place, being intellects without bodies, pure intellects, would never be so frivolous as to dance in any way. And if they were to dance, they'd have more sense than to dance on the head of a pin. But the real question, the question that was discussed, of which that silly question makes mock, is the question whether angels stand in relation to place the way bodies stand in relation to place. A one-car garage will hold one car. The seat you're sitting in right now, Milt, is occupied by your bulk and resists my bulk from occupying it, excludes me. The question properly put is, when an angel acts on a body by the exercise of its spiritual power, does it exclude other angels from acting on that same body at that time? The answer to that question is a firm yes. Only one angel can exercise its spiritual power on a given body at a given time. And the precise way of saying that is the intensive spiritual occupation of space is exclusive exactly as the extensive material occupation of space.
You're a pretty smart fella. Lots of people hold that opinion of you.
I hold it of myself, as a matter of fact.
I was about to say, you probably even think of yourself as a pretty smart fellow, but it's for me and for all your many admirers to say you're a brilliant man, and as I said a moment ago, one of our national treasures. Therefore, why are you spending your time writing a book about angels when you yourself say, and I quote from a document that I hold in my hand, a speech that you'll be giving shortly, as a philosopher and as a pagan, I do not believe in angels. If you don't believe in them, why have you spent a year putting this quite brilliant and fascinating book together? You're writing about something you don't believe in.
The reason why I do not believe in angels, as I would say on the contrary that I believe in God, is that as a philosopher, I think I have been able to marshal an argument that establishes for my mind the existence of God beyond a reasonable doubt. There is a philosophical argument, which I think is sound, that establishes the existence of God. There is no philosophical argument to establish the existence or reality of angels. Their reality is affirmed by religious Jews, Orthodox Jews, Orthodox Christians, both Protestant and Catholic, and Protestant as much as Catholic. I'll support that statement in a moment, and by Orthodox members of Islam.
Even if the Jews aren't religious but draw from the tradition, it's every place in one's vocabulary. My father used to say, and still would, I'm sure, of somebody who seems an unpleasant presence, mit ihm geht der Malachamovis, with him goes the angel of death.
Yeah. Very common. Or the angel phrase. Of the Lord will be said.
Yeah.
Now, you say, why as a philosopher? For two reasons. First, I think materialism, metaphysical materialism, not moral materialism, is wrong. I think it has no grounds whatsoever. And materialism, the materialistic philosophy, which is so abundant in our day on all sides, says that angels are impossible. I think I was clear in my mind that I could prove that angels are quite possible, that they are entirely possible, not impossible. Let's postpone that argument for a moment. The possibility of angels makes the religious belief in their reality defensible and reasonable. If the materialists were right, that angels being purely spiritual beings were impossible, the religious belief would be unfounded. I mean, faith cannot be contrary to reason. Faith can never, if reason could show that angels are impossible, then faith would be invalidated. So I'm defending faith indirectly by arguing philosophically that angels, purely spiritual beings, minds without body, are quite possible.
And thereby, you say, defining angels as mind without body, and that's the definition on which the whole book is based, you are not only defending the possibility of the religious belief in angels, though not confirming it philosophically.
That's right.
You're also doing something else. You are also attacking a philosophical position, which is the basic philosophical position of the secularized modern age, and that is materialism, which asserts that there is nothing in reality but material, stuff.
Bodies, one sort or another.
We've come from Democritus's, the simple atomic theory of Democritus. We've advanced in recent years to an understanding that there are smaller particles than atoms. They go to make up atoms. And we know now as well that we can't just simply call them material. They interact with and are energy and become substance or energy interchangeably. But that's still a form of matter.
Sure.
And that leaves out all such, that renders meaningless and nonsensical such words as spirit,
God,
mind, mind in certain conceptions of mind. And you are strongly saying, but with a kind of an indirect swerve around left end, you are saying materialism itself is demonstrably inadequate.
Let me say that another way.
You'd better, because I made a hash of it.
The materialistic premise is nothing exists except bodies in one form or another. With regard to that premise, let me say, it is unproved. I've never seen a proof that nothing exists except bodies, and I think it's unprovable. The inference then this is what quite remarkable, Mel. The inference then that the materialist makes is as follows: nothing exists except bodies. Angels are said to be minds without bodies. Hence, angels cannot exist. They should have said, the right inference would: angels do not exist. If nothing exists except bodies, and angels are minds without bodies, then angels do not exist. It doesn't follow that they cannot exist. I mean, they made it really an invalid inference. So there is no ground whatsoever for their declaring the impossibility of angels. Now, if I have many positive reasons for showing that angels are possible. Once you talk about them as a possible mode of being, then they become interesting objects of philosophical exploration. That is, it's like dealing with hypothetical entities. And a lot of very good thinking is thinking about things that may not exist, but their possibility raises all kinds of questions. So that's why I justify a purely philosophical exploration of that possibility.
But what will the philosophical exploration of that possibility, which you do in the book and of which we will do a shorter and simpler version tonight in our discussion, what does that philosophical exploration of the possibility of the existence of angels tell us other than the possible existence of angels?
Well,
how does it bear on other matters that interest you?
It's precisely the interest is that when one explores angels as possible modes of being, as disembodied or unembodied intellects or minds without bodies, one discovers certain properties that they must have. In one little place I say that angelology is very much like mathematics. From a very small set of initial premises, a whole series of conclusions follow. In a kind of a hypothetical science, angelology, for the philosopher who is not affirming the existence, the reality of angels by faith, but begins with that possibility, is a kind of deductive science.
There once was a theological subdiscipline called angelology.
Oh, yeah.
It isn't practiced much these days, is it?
I'm very anxious to say this. Some contemporary writers, one of whom reviewed my book, acts as if angelology belonged to the Middle Ages only. Karl Barth, in my judgment, a member of the Reformed Church, a leading Lutheran, is by all odds the most eminent of Protestant theologians. His great book is a 9-volume work called Church Dogmatics. One whole volume of Karl Barth's Church Dogmatics is devoted to the discussion of angels. And it's a magnificent treatise. That's the 20th century, not the 13th century.
Does Karl Barth believe in the existence
of
angels?
Oh, yes.
How does he persuade himself?
Scripture. I mean, the evidence that, after all Christian beliefs, all Christian dogmas, as Jewish dogmas or Muslim, are based upon the revealed word of God, the interpreted exegesis of Scripture. And no one could take Scripture seriously and deny that angels are present in the Scripture.
Now, you are writing as a philosopher, and you will not settle for a scriptural proof.
No.
You're saying, as a philosopher, can I demonstrate to myself the possibility that angels
exist? Only the possibility, not the reality.
Yet you spend about one-third of the book reviewing the scriptural and religious tradition.
Because I think it's a matter of great interest. I think it fits into, if one is interested in understanding Christianity and Judaism and Islam, one should understand this article of Christian faith. Also because all of us, I think, are interested in Lucifer or Satan, who is a fallen angel. All of us interested in the Christian and Jewish account of sin. One can't deal with sin without thinking of Lucifer, the original sin, you see.
So man's sin begins with Adam, but the mover in Adam's sin
was Satan.
The enemy. And his was the ultimate sin of abandoning the grace of the presence of God for no conceivable reason.
Rejecting it. Being offered it. And almost saying, look, I'll get along by myself. Don't, you don't have to give me any gifts, you see. It's an extraordinary rejection. And I suppose the word pride is the right word for that sin. It's a special kind of pride.
Pride went before Lucifer's fall.
That's right.
Yeah.
So that only one-third of the book deals with angels as objects of religious belief. The second main part is angels as objects of philosophical thought. And it's the third main part, the angelistic fallacies in modern thought, that is the ultimate purpose of the book, because I think that the philosophical exploration of angels leads us to understand why philosophers who treat the human soul and the human intellect as if it were an incarnate angel, an angel somehow inhabiting or related to it, make tremendous mistakes with all kinds of consequences in modern thought that should be corrected, I think.
Let's pursue that line. What are the angelistic fallacies which are to be found in modern thought about the human mind?
Let me deal with the obvious ones first, then come to the profound one. The obvious ones are, I name four of them, angelistic politics, angelistic psychology, angelistic linguistics, and angelistic ethics. Angelistic politics, it consists in thinking that man can live peacefully, the human beings can live peacefully in a community in harmony and justice with no government. Alexander Hamilton's famous remark, if men were angels, no government would be necessary. But men are not angels, therefore we have to have coercive force. The philosophical anarchism, not bomb-throwing anarchism, not terrorism, but philosophical anarchism is angelistic. Fallaciously angelistic. It attributes to man a property that man does not have.
Yes, well, but Hamilton did not attribute that property. However, people like, say, Prince Kropotkin did.
Kropotkin and Bakunin.
The anarchists as such.
There are some American anarchists who...
Yeah.
So that's angelistic politics.
Uh-huh.
Angelistic psychology consists of telepathy and telepathy. Lots of human beings think that I can read your mind or I can put thoughts in your mind without using physical means of communication. The angels do communicate telepathically, and
if they exist.
If there are angels,
then they communicate telepathically.
That's right, precisely the point. I mean, all this is hypothetical.
Well, since they have no bodies, they're not going to communicate through speech or through
sign
language.
And they act when an angel acts on a body, it acts at a distance, as no body can act at a distance on another. An angel from heaven doesn't have to come to earth to act on a body.
So all the modern plague of dull-witted parapsychological
all parapsychology is angelistic.
Is angelistic.
That's right. All parapsychology is angelistic.
And it's the angelistic fallacy mental process.
Right. Two. Three, angelistic linguistics. This is really an extraordinary area by a great modern philosopher, Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz, who was so concerned about the ambiguity of human speech, the fact that human beings, that language was such an imperfect medium of communication, that he wanted to invent a language which he called not mathematics now, because that has a very limited range of meanings, But a complete language, a conventional language, dealing with every possible object, in which every symbol had a unique and unchangeable meaning, so that human communication would be perfect. No misunderstanding. Now, angels can communicate that way, without using language, so that Leibniz's attempt to create what he called the universal characteristic was to try to give man a property that angels have. That's angelistic linguistics. And angelistic ethics consists in the most extraordinary error made by Socrates. Knowledge is virtue. If I know what is right,
I will necessarily do what is right.
That's angel. And that
how is that angelistic?
Because angels.
That would be true of angels.
The good angels existed. Conform their will to their knowledge. Yes.
Passion doesn't interfere.
No passion. That's right. Yeah. We have passion. The reason why Socrates is wrong is because we're passionate. We're bodily. A pure intellect would do what is right when it knows what is right. So modern.
These are all angelistic fallacies, and therefore they don't really apply to man. They apply only to angels.
Yeah. These are fallacies of attributing to man properties that belong only to angels. But
yes.
The most serious, those are not, the most serious problem is, or the most serious error in modern thought, it's just not, I'm wrong in saying it's modern. It begins with Plato. The notion of body and soul, as is found in Plato, in the great dialogue in the jail when Socrates is dying and his friends beg him to talk about the immortality of the soul.
That's the Phaedo.
Phaedo.
Yeah.
Socrates has an argument for the immortality of the soul, which is persuasive, but wrong. The soul, he says, is a simple spiritual thing. It's immaterial. Matter, composed of parts, decomposes. The soul, being simple, doesn't decompose. And so when the body dies, decomposing and disintegrating, the soul is freed. And for Plato, the soul, and this persisted in through all the centuries of the Middle Ages, most Christians, most Jews, most Muslim philosophers were all Platonists because it gave such an easy hold on immortality. The soul is in the body, they said, as the rower is in the boat or the driver in the car. The car can break up, but the driver, the boat can sink, but the driver, the rower can swim, you see? So that, that made man not one, but two. When you say all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, Socrates is mortal, that isn't true. Which is Socrates, the soul or the body? Is he both? He's both mortal and immortal, you see?
No. Well, mortal is immortality is a state of affairs which refers to an end, but to an end only of the body.
That's right.
And not of the persisting soul.
That's right. Now, that view, Jacques Maritain properly described as the incarnation of the angel. In other words, mm-hmm. It's putting an angelic being into or associated with a corporeal substance, a body. Descartes repeats the Platonic error. You know, the two substances, res extensa and res cogitans, thinking substance and extended substance, conjoined. How conjoined? In no sensible way, because the Cartesian intellect doesn't need the body, doesn't depend upon the senses, doesn't learn. And notice all the angelistic errors, the doctrine of innate ideas, the doctrine that the mind never that sleep is not a property of the human intellect. The mind is always active, contrary to all the facts, because only a body would cause a mind to sleep. Only a mind that's really connected with the body, a pure intellect, somehow associated with the body wouldn't.
But this is where your book confuses me. And let me tell you why. In what you're saying right now, you're reflecting some of the content of the book, but you seem to be suggesting that the distinction between mind and body is a distinction that makes no sense at all.
Oh, no.
Yet.
Oh, I'm only saying. Forgive me for a moment.
All right.
I'm only saying the error is to regard mind and body as two distinct substances.
So you're rejecting what is called in the trade dualism.
Absolutely.
But you're not settling for materialism as the opposite of dualism.
No.
You're not settling. As a psychologist who went through the standard graduate training in psychology, I was taught a long time ago, there is no such thing as mind separate from body. All that we call mind is a function of structure, especially of the nervous system. Therefore, we are purely materialistic in our understanding of the mental life. So I was taught.
May I This may take me a few seconds.
It's a crucial question.
How about, there are five positions, and the middle position of the five is the correct one. No, you weren't taught this one, because this is the one that's ignored by modern thinkers all the way down the line.
I was taught radical materialism.
Right. There are two. On the materialistic side, there are two forms of what is called the identity hypothesis, is what you're saying. One is the most good thinkers don't hold. It's the extreme reductive form, namely that brain and mind are not only existentially inseparable, but analytically indistinct.
Yeah.
That the more moderate materialists reject. They say, if you were to describe in words brain processes, and at the same time describe the accompanying mind processes, though they are identical in existence, they are analytically distinct, the same words won't describe them. The same words will not describe the concurrent processes in the brain and actions of the mind. Analytically distinct, but they hold the position, which is the materialist, the good materialist position, that the brain is not only the necessary condition of mental action, but sufficient. That's materialism. At the other extreme, the most extreme is Berkeley. There's no matter at all. In fact, Berkeley makes the human being an angel. Berkeley is angelism to the extreme. We are pure spirit.
He says our corporeal existence is an illusion, possibly.
That's right. We are pure spirit.
That's the famous Bishop Berkeley, who was refuted by Dr. Johnson.
Kicking a stone.
By kicking a stone and saying, thus do I refute Bishop Berkeley.
That's right.
I never quite understood the nature of that proof, but it's a strong it's assertion.
All you have to do is go to sleep and wake up and ask what happened to understand why Berkeley is wrong. Now, at that extreme position, the Berkeleyan position, is just as wrong as the reductive materialist position. So I've got one good position over here, the identity hypothesis, when it's moderate and allows for an analytic distinction between mind and brain. Coming in from Berkeley, still on the immaterialist side.
By the way, do you want to call that idealism or spiritualism?
Let me call it immaterialism.
Immaterialism.
Materialism and immaterialism.
All right, the opposite of material.
Yeah, the more moderate immaterialist position is Plato and Descartes. The dualistic position, that we are made of two substances, a spiritual substance, which is the intellect or the rational soul, and a material substance of the body, and they are conjoined as a rower is in the boat or a driver in the car. I've already indicated all the difficulties with that position. That really makes the rational soul of the intellect an angel incarnate.
Yes, and for Plato, at least, I'm not quite sure where Descartes stands on this, but you were pointing this up a moment ago with reference to the Phaedo, Plato's great dialogue about the death of Socrates. When the corporeal substance begins to dissolve and comes to death, the non-corporeal substance persists.
Sure. It's emancipated.
It goes on forever.
It's emancipated. The body is a kind of a prison house.
Yeah.
That marvelous poem of Wordsworth, which we ought to read a little later, it says that the trailing clouds of glory do come heaven on, which is our home, does our soul come, and the shades of the prison house fall, the body, in case.
Finally sprung from prison.
Now, in between those two extremes, the two materialist positions, and the two immaterialist positions, is the Aristotelian position, which is unknown to most contemporary thinkers. I know you were not taught it in any psychology course taught in any modern university.
No, I was not, though I've become familiar with it, and it is very well elucidated in your new book, The Angels and Us. And you've played right into my hands. We're at the very point where I've got to say, this is WGN, Clear Channel Radio from Chicago, and pause for just a bit for some messages. And so we will develop the Aristotelian middle view on this basic matter right after these words.
Extension 720 continues with your host, Milt Rosenberg.
Milt? Thank you very much, Jack Taylor. Our guest tonight, Mortimer J. Adler, and we are drawing from his newest book, The Angels and Us, which is to be published officially tomorrow by the Macmillan Publishing Company. So, we've differentiated, if only now to put them aside, four positions. Extreme materialism, moderate or moderated materialism, extreme immaterialism, and moderate immaterialism. We land in the middle with a fifth position, and we turn to old Aristotle for it.
And it leans to the materialistic side, by the way. It says that man, for the most part, is a corporeal organism, and that most of his functions are performed by corporeal organs. His digestive and alimentary functions by an alimentary system. His locomotive functions by a skeletal system and muscles. His imagination, his memory, his imagination, and his sense perception.
Even his imagination and his memory.
By the brain.
Mental functions of a sort.
Not intellectual. They're sensitive.
The kinds of functions that we take to be the business of psychology, say.
See, I think, you see, that at that point man is an animal. That man's sensitive functions are no different from the animal sense. I think that the brute animals don't have intellects. When we use the word mind there, they have sensitive intelligence, imagination and memory. They have all those things because the brain is the organ of sense and imagination. Now, what Aristotle says, that as we see with our eye, the eye is the organ of vision, the ear is the organ of hearing, the skeletal structure is the organ of local motion, the alimentary system is the organ of digestion and nutrition, the brain is not the organ of thought. We see with our, we cannot think without our brain, but we don't think with our brain. Now, what are you saying at that point?
We cannot think without the brain,
but
we
don't think with it.
What does that mean?
I'm going to explain. It's as simple as this. The good materialist position, that's why it's a very narrow and beautiful issue. The good materialist position, the identity hypothesis in the moderate form, says the brain is both a necessary and a sufficient condition for thought. Aristotle says necessary but not sufficient. Necessary, but not. Why not sufficient? Because it's necessary because we cannot think without perceptions and memories and imaginations. But we go beyond them. The human intellect is able to think of that which is not perceptible at all, not merely unperceived, not perceptible or detectable in any way. It has a reach to the immaterial, the universal. For example, when we apprehend things in their universal nature, we're apprehending anything that is... If I say to you, triangle, the simple case, the conceptual element triangle, you can't imagine. If you start to imagine triangle, it'll be an equilateral, scalene, or a right-angle triangle. You cannot possibly imagine a triangle.
Instead of picturing any one of those different kinds of triangles, I would probably, if you gave me the stimulus word, say a three-sided closed figure.
Yeah, but you see, you can't hold an image of that. There's no... You go to try to draw one. Try to draw a triangle on the board, and you'll draw a particular triangle. But you can think triangle.
I've got an image, even as I say it,
sure,
but the image is of an equilateral.
Sure, that's right.
Which must be the common way of imaging triangles.
Precisely. Yeah. But that's not triangle. And that's a very simple way of understanding that the mind grasps that which is imperceptible and unimaginable. Well, I can think about God. God is totally imperceptible and unimaginable. Angels are totally imperceptible and unimaginable. I can think about angels. Most of higher mathematics has ideal objects that are totally imperceptible. This cannot be done by matter. The basic distinction between men and brutes is that brutes are capable of perceptual abstraction, perceptual object. The brutes perform perceptual thought. Man, in addition to having perceptual thought, which is the act of his brain and sense organs, has conceptual thought, which is the act of his intellect. So what Aristotle is saying, if you almost want to say, if you take all the powers of man, let me say six of them, they're the vegetative powers, nutrition, growth, and reproduction, the three basic, those are organic. So that three represents man's bodily functions. The two animal powers, sense, all its range, the whole range of sense powers, and the whole range of locomotive powers, makes five. But there's a sixth power, intellection, which exceeds the body. So that one sixth of man is above matter. Just one sixth. Hence, when I say, following my old friend Aquinas, that man stands on the boundary line between the material and the spiritual world. Whether the spiritual world is real or reality or possibility, the point's the same. The fact that it may not be real is of no importance. Man stands on the boundary line between what is corporeal and what is incorporeal. If I were Platonic, I would say he stands on that boundary line by having one foot in each realm. See? He has his bodily foot is in the corporeal realm. His soul is in the spiritual realm. Aristotle would say no. Man is entirely standing in the material realm and can lean over into the spiritual by the reach of his mind. In other words, that's a crucial difference. Instead of straddling that boundary line between the corporeal and the spiritual, he doesn't straddle it. He is corporeal for the most part with that one reach. of his mind into the spiritual. Now, let me add one more thing. This is subject to empirical test. I don't think we know yet, but given time now, we have the means for deciding which of those two, the only two really, in my judgment, competing theories, is the materialistic moderate identity hypothesis. The extreme one is impossible, and anyone that says that there's no distinction at all between mind and brain is talking nonsense. But the materialist has a strong position. There's much evidence in support of the moderate materialist position. I think there's much evidence in support of the Aristotelian moderate position, you see. And those are the two positions that vie for the future. Platonism and Cartesianism is just outlandish as Bishop Berkeley.
Well, now, what difference does it make? One of your wonderful early books was The Difference of Man and The Difference It Makes.
Do I have the title right?
If you settle for the Aristotelian view that there is an edge of incorporeality about us, what difference does it make to how we will then think about ourselves, about our fate, or whatever?
I will answer your question. There is one pathogen genesis on which all the Western religions, since Genesis is common to Jews, Christians, and Islam, one passage that you can't get around. Man and man alone, it is said, is made in the image of God. Man is not made in the image of God on the materialistic hypothesis. Man is made. Man is a person, not a thing, because of that little edge of spirit. Intellect and free will. Intellect, a person, is a being with intellect and free will. Now, man has it. Man is the least intellect in the universe. Man is the least person in the universe. Man is the least spirit in the universe. But spirit, he is a little bit.
He's at the bottom of that scale, but it's an elevated scale.
That's right. Now, that's what makes the difference. I say, if the materialist, I've said this to large assemblages of religious persons, they really won't face the fact. I say, if the materialist position ever gets proved, namely that man is purely material, your religion, Judaism, goes out the window. I mean, that's absolutely, it hasn't, you can believe it if you want to, but it's an unreasonable, indefensible belief. On this one point, everything hangs.
You know, reading your book yesterday in my office, I came upon a sentence which combines the names of two interesting intellectual figures, Aristotle and Carl Sagan. And since Sagan is an old friend of mine, I was tempted to pick up the phone and call Cornell, except he's hardly ever there anymore, and tell him Mortimer Adler has put you in the same sentence with Aristotle, which would have surprised him. The reference there is that if man is at the very bottom of that order of beings who possess spirit, then all those other beings that Sagan has been much exercised about, the ones who may be out there in extended galactic space, are not different from us in kind,
only in
but
degree.
If more intelligent, they are only different
precisely.
In a quantitative way.
Precisely.
They may be more intelligent, but still they're like us.
Precisely. Precisely. Must be. They can be nothing superior to man in kind except an angel.
Or God.
Or God. Pure spirit. So if there are extraterrestrial intelligences, they either are inferior to us, or equal to us, or superior to us in degree, but no different in kind.
Now, I'm going to rush in where angels fear to tread, since I am a natural-born fool, and argue both against you and even against Aristotle. The key argument, as you were drawing from Aristotle, is that we know that there is an element of spirit in man's mentation, in his intellect, as it operates, because man forms concepts. You didn't use that term, but that's what you mean.
Conceptual
forms concepts of things that, as for example, the idealized triangle, for which there is no simple referent. That he can point to or that he can draw and handle all things that have triangular quality.
That's right.
I offer you another author, and I know you've read him, and I'm sure that you dislike almost everything he's got to say and find him foolish, B.H. Skinner, the great modern behavioristic psychologist.
You couldn't have mentioned anyone I dislike more.
I rather thought so. But Skinner works from a tradition. He didn't invent all of this by himself. He would say of our conceptual activity, whether we conceive triangles or justice or anything of the sort, that all thinking is essentially in words. other kinds of signs and symbols, but essentially in words.
But words have meanings. Where do the meanings come from?
Essentially, they are buzzes in the complex circuitry of the human brain. And furthermore, those very same similar buzzes occur in the brains of other organisms. And there is no qualitative difference between our intellection and the intellection, say, of our high and near animal neighbors, the anthropoid apes, or possibly the dolphins and the whales and what have you.
I don't think it's too immodest of me to refer to a large and heavy book that I wrote on this subject some years ago, like more than 10 years ago now, a book called The Difference of Man and the Difference It Makes, which I examined carefully. I mean, I did my homework well. I examined all the evidence, not just Skinner, but much more important books than Skinner, by far. I examined all the evidence at that time, and on what are called artificial intelligence. I examined all the arguments about the chimpanzees and about the porpoises, the dolphin. It is every bit of evidence I examined persuaded me that animals are capable only of perceptual thought, perceptual abstraction. I'm using the word abstraction, perceptual abstraction. They can only think about, and their minds only operate with perceptually present objects. Never with the perceptually absent or with the imperceptible. There is not the slightest evidence in any animal experiment of animals dealing with the perceptually absent, or the imperceptible.
Can we do a little debate on this? Let me offer you a case in point. It's a famous case in point, a famous study done in about 1914 or 1915. You know this stuff better than I do. Wolfgang Köhler on the Tenerife Islands, where he was incarcerated because he was a German, and he does this research with a bunch of chimpanzees.
I translated the book into English, so I know the book very well.
Did you actually?
Yes.
I didn't know.
I mean, it was published by Albert and Charles Bonai, and Köhler thought he could write English. And so he wrote absolutely a broken English. I didn't translate it from the German. I took his broken English and made it English.
I never knew that.
It was the hardest job I ever did in my life.
All right, then of course you well remember. To quickly review just one of the experiments for our listeners. You take a chimp who wants a banana. You've rendered him hungry, and on a mesh ceiling in the courtyard, beyond the chimp's reach, there hangs a cluster of bananas.
It all has to be within the same perceptual frame. The whole point about that was exactly my point.
Let me finish telling the tale, though, so those who are listening can get it clear. The chimp jumps towards the banana. He can't get it. He's frustrated. He thrashes around a bit. He goes off in the corner and sulks for a while to anthropomorphize. At least he sits, and we might say he seems to be thinking. Suddenly he jumps up and runs around the yard where there are some 5 or 6 boxes scattered, and he piles them on top of one another
and quickly climbs up
and gets the banana. Köhler, as you know, said the ape has had an aha experience. He has, in mental process, imagined the piling of the boxes, and that's a kind of great conceptual idea, an invention.
No.
And it's all occurred in mind. In mind, he has realized that will do it, then he dashes off and executes it physically.
Milt, you've left out one important element in the description of the experiment. If the boxes... I know this very well. The other experiment is the banana outside the cage and a cloth which the ape then leans through the cage and beats the cloth till the banana jumps on the cloth and he pulls it in. I know all the things. I wrote the book in English. In every one of the cases, and this is the whole point about the gestalt, the instrument the ape uses must be in the same perceptual frame. If those boxes could not be seen by the ape at the same moment that he's seeing the banana, in other words, if he saw the banana and had to turn away and at a different time see the boxes, he would never connect the boxes with the banana. It's by seeing the boxes and the banana that he puts them together in the gestalt.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I mean by the perceptually present object. He doesn't have any conceptual thought at all. I'm sorry. None of the gestalt work shows that. In fact, no animal, I reviewed all the animal experimentation that was in the literature. There isn't any evidence. Heinrich Kluver's work is much better than that. And it's all perceptual, all perceptual. So that I don't, and there's no evidence, I mean, all the much over-exaggerated work about the chimpanzees learning to speak.
The more recent research with linguistic chimps.
If you look at that, there isn't a word. I use the word in quotes in a chimp's vocabulary. I use the word vocabulary, which does not refer to a perceptual object. There isn't a conceptual word there. Can't be. They can't handle it. They can only attach these symbols that they're taught how to use to perceptual objects.
What about the great mammals of the sea? We can barely research with them at all, but we seem to have evidence of very high levels of intelligence.
I'm not saying.
But it's still that other kind of intelligence.
I'm not saying that the primates and that the dolphins are not very intelligent. They are, but it's perceptive. I would say that just as man is the lowest in the order of intellects, so the apes and the dolphins are the highest in the order of... I think that they're as good as man's perceptual intelligence.
So the difference of man and in man is that he thinks about that which is not present.
And not only that which is unperceived, but that which is imperceptible. Both unperceived and imperceptible. Unimaginable, too.
Ultimately, for example, are thinking about God.
Or about any mathematics and any ideal. When we talk about multidimensional, we can think imaginatively about three-dimensional geometry. But there are lots of geometries that have 10 dimensions. Not imaginable at all.
There's another broad area in which we think about that which is imaginable but not present in any manifested way, and that's what your last book was about. Great ideas are all of that order, aren't they?
They're all of that order, sure.
When we think of justice...
What do we think about? Well, you imagine justice for a moment. Perceive justice.
Yeah. And one would argue even the most brilliant ape or the most brilliant whale does not think about justice.
No, not the slightest evidence that they do. Not the slightest evidence.
But it would be very hard to get that evidence. If
by using the various forms of sign language that men teach chimpanzees, you could begin... Well, let me see if I can do it another way. How do children learn language? They first learn language by having names imposed on perceptual objects. Daddy, doggy, cat, nursey.
And when the kid is 3 years old and swats another kid, the mother may say to him, that was not fair.
Yes.
And that's the beginning of the concept of justice.
Precisely. The child acquires the word fair. Unfair. Not fair, see? What physical object? What perceptible presence is that word applied to? None. And you try to teach any chimpanzee to say not fair. And you will fail.
I suppose you would. Here's a curious thing. Suppose you work down the human scale in terms of power of intellect. There are people of great brilliance. One of them is sitting across the table from me. There are people of average or considerable intelligence. I would flatter myself I'm another. There are people supposedly of average intelligence, however you define that. There are also unfortunates who are, in the old phrase, feeble-minded or defective. How far do you go down the scale from normal to moron to imbecile to idiot in the old classification and still have these special qualities which are human?
Again, on the Platonic and Cartesian, you can't explain imbeciles at all. In other words... You can't have degrees of intellect. Those things, degrees of intellect in that sense. The brain is a necessary condition of thought. Hence, there are better and worse brains. The brains of the feeble-minded are pathologically defective brains, and therefore the necessary condition of thought is defective in them. So that whatever intellectual power they have is weakened by the necessary condition it has to operate with. Let me illustrate. Aquinas, Aquinas, who held Aristotle's position, knows about brain lesions, knows about drugs, knows about fatigue, and how these things slowing the bodily organ up or affects thought. He's thoroughly, the reason he argues against Plato are these evidences of the bodily, the dependence of the mind upon its bodily counterpart. See? So he's not saying... No, nobody at all. He's saying, nevertheless, even though the brain and all its actions is a necessary condition, and if it's weaker, it weakens the intellect, weakens the operation of the intellect. Nevertheless, the intellectual operation is not reducible to it. You see, it is something that is over and above. There's an immaterial component there that goes along with the material component. It's a very special kind of dualism. It isn't a dualism of substance. It's a dualism of powers. We have one power. If you talk about the living powers, the vital powers, we have one power, the intellect, which is an immaterial power, that must co-function. Let me make this point, I think, clearest of all. If Plato and Descartes were right, there is one Christian doctrine that would be horrendous, abominable, the resurrection of the body. If the intellect doesn't need the body, if in fact the body is as any Plato would say, the soul's prison house, what is God doing to us when we go to heaven and he resurrects, puts us back into a body? We have escaped. Death frees us, liberates us from that prison house of the body, you see? So the doctrine of the resurrection of the body should be denied by any Platonistic Christian.
All right. What about the doctrine of the persistence of the soul? The persistence of that in man's intellection, which is of a highest and a qualitatively distinctive order in comparison to all the other forms of corporeal life.
This, I now will lose some friends among my Christian followers. And Jewish as well, of all the religious doctrines that are common to the three great religions of the West, the one that I think has the weakest support in reason is the immortality of the soul. I mean, Aquinas tries to, I mean, Aristotle doesn't succeed in arguing for it. Aquinas tries to argue for it. See, it's not being, the Platonic view of the soul makes it very easy to argue for the immortality of the soul.
Uh-huh.
And did you know, by the way, that in the 13th century, when Aquinas finally became the exponent of the Aristotelian doctrine of the soul, not as a substance, but merely as the form of an organic body, his books were burned in Paris, his books were burned in Oxford, and the Bishop of Paris, Bishop Tempe, had him up for excommunication for heresy. Because clearly the Platonic view of the soul was the one that supported the Christian doctrine of the immortality, and Aquinas stuck to his guns, that Plato was wrong on empirical grounds, and that even though it was very difficult, he has a proof which is very tenuous of the immortality of the soul. I'll say it for you very quickly. He held to it. And his holding to it was a heroic act, because by holding to it, he connected the immortality of the soul with the resurrection of the body. The soul, which subsists, which perseveres the death of the body, can only be sustained until the last judgment by God's grace. It doesn't have a real life, because it doesn't have a real, doesn't function without the body. In between death now and the last judgment, because the resurrection of the body comes at the end of time, the bodiless soul can only be sustained by God. It does not really, of its own nature, subsist.
It's in what airline pilots call a holding pattern.
That's right, exactly right.
Until the day of judgment.
That's right.
And what happens to it as the soul after the day of judgment?
Well, with the resurrected body, it again, in heaven, has its natural condition. Because it needs a body. The soul needs a body.
Uh-huh.
That's how slightly immaterialist Aquinas is, you see.
But you don't stand with Aquinas on that.
Yes, I do. Except that I think the argument is very weak. I mean, I don't say Aquinas is wrong. I say, in the sense in which I think there's a very persuasive argument for God's existence, the argument for the purely philosophical argument for the immortality of the soul without religious belief is very, very weak. It consists in saying this. The crucial premise is, a thing, according as a thing operates, so does it exist. The intellect operates, is able to operate immaterially, therefore it exists immaterially.
There's a wonderful contrast between the three Western religions,
yeah,
and the Eastern religions in this matter. For all of the three Western religions, there is some persistence in the form of soul of individuality. In the Eastern religions, in the Hindu-Buddhist tradition, upon death, that in oneself which is eternal and comes from the eternal grand singularity that is the only ultimate reality, that in oneself, having shed the prison of the body, well, either infuses a new life form and is reborn, the karmic cycle, but at the end of that karmic cycle is that moment of ultimate fulfillment in which all identity is cast aside and you rejoin the Brahman in Hindu vocabulary.
Only in the West do you have the notion of individual immortality.
Do you have hope of immortality?
I would say of all my hopes, that's the weakest.
The weakest?
The weakest, yes. I mean, if you said to me, what is my major obstacle to becoming a religious Jew or Christian or Muslim? It is that the belief in the existence of God is by no means sufficient. One must believe in the immortality of the soul.
Uh-huh.
Without that, none of these three religions have their full force. And there I have philosophical difficulties of the greatest, be an act of faith without
that's
any...
That's what keeps you a pagan.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, then what consolation is to be found in your discovery of something non-corporeal in the very nature of human intellect?
I can answer that by saying this. It's very weak. The arguments that Aquinas offers are arguments to show that the immortality of the soul is not impossible. It doesn't show that the immortality of the soul is real. I mean, his arguments show that it is possible, with God's help, for the soul to persist after the death of the body. But that's a very, only possible. It's like my saying, I don't believe in angels, but I can show that they're possible. I don't believe in the immortality of the soul, but I think it's not impossible for the soul to be immortal. Not impossible.
But let me work in a quick ID. This is WGN, Clear Channel Radio from Chicago, and the phone lines are open, as usual. The number 591-7200, 591-7200. And we'll be on to the call shortly. I've got to persist on this one thing, because it interests me so much in terms of finding some way of organizing meaning in my own life and in what's left of it. I think it's Alexander Pope who says, presume not God's ways to scan, the proper study of mankind is man. That is Pope, isn't it?
It is Pope.
All right.
The essay on man.
The essay on man. Then, if the proper study of mankind is man, and the proper things to deliberate and to make choices about and to form new resolve over is what to do with one's life as a man, as a human, how does the kind of illumination that you've been examining in your book and in our conversation tonight, how does that bear upon what to do with a life, one's own life, and with one's obligations, responsibilities, or relations to others?
The ethical implications of seeing that man is not a pure spirit but a rational animal, of knowing that Socrates is wrong saying that knowledge is virtue, are very significant ones. I mean, I think Aristotelian ethics is an ethics that fits Aristotelian psychology. In other words, to put it another way, Socrates says at the end of his trial, the people who condemned him in the jury. Know you, my friends, he said, that no harm can come to a good man in this life or the next. That's angelistic.
Uh-huh.
I mean, do anything you want to my body, but my soul is untouchable by you. No harm. If my soul is good inwardly, you can't do me any harm. That's wrong, says Aristotle. You can do me harm, because I'm not just a rational soul. I'm a body, and you can injure me in a variety of ways. So that the Aristotelian conception of man as mainly material with just that spiritual reach has profound ethical consequences. I hate to keep saying this, but I know that so many of my contemporaries think I'm a madman for saying it, but Aristotle is the only sound, sensible, common sense philosopher in the world. In the West, certainly.
None since?
None that I know. Not one. I would say that Aristotle's ethics is the only sound, practical, and undogmatic moral philosophy there is. Totally undogmatic. There are no rules of conduct. No rules of conduct at all.
What was there that about him that got him so close to the most available and most well-considered truths?
I think because he had the respect that I think a philosopher should have for the common opinions of mankind, for common sense. He tried to talk about the world and human life and man in terms that made sense to our ordinary experience of it.
I'm trying to remember the title of one of your books of a few years ago, the one about Aristotle, Aristotle for Everybody.
Yeah. And let me say about that, that there is not another philosopher I would say for everybody. Plato for everybody? Kant, Immanuel Kant for everybody, Descartes for everybody, John Locke, no. Just Aristotle. No other.
And possibly Mortimer Adler.
Well, that's my job. I mean, to do Aristotle up, frown for everybody.
They're eager to talk with you, of course, and we're going to turn to the telephones, though I've got some other things I want to get on the table, but I mustn't abuse our listeners, so we'll let them get at you first. The number 591-7200, 591-7200, right back and directly onto your phone calls for Mortimer J. Adler after this.
This is Extension 720, which continues now with your host, Milt Rosenberg. Milt?
Thank you, Jack Taylor. Corporeal at the moment, but certainly possessing an immortal soul. Well, we don't know whether Jack Taylor's soul is immortal, but we know he's got one.
Well, he has a mind, certainly.
What about that, by the way, the use of the word soul and the interchangeability? It isn't in common parlance interchangeable anymore, but in much of the classic writing, when they speak of soul, they really mean mind, don't they?
Well, no, they both play on aerosol. No. The plants have souls. Vegetables have souls, as well as animals have souls. Only man has a rational soul. And the only soul said to be immortal is the rational soul because of its reason or intellect.
Mm-hmm. The word nous in the Greek is...
intellect.
Is intellect specifically.
Yeah.
Our number, 591-7200, for conversation with Mortimer Adler, and here is the first caller. Good evening.
Hello, I have a few questions. First of all, I'd wondered if these are sensible questions. Are there laws that God can't break or things he can't do? And Sagan, in one of his programs, indicated if we can ask all these questions about where things come from, why isn't it a sensible question to ask where God came from? I'd like to stop there. I've got one more.
Can I answer those two questions first?
Sure.
To the first question, a great theologian gave an affirmative answer. There are things that God cannot do. God's infinite power does not extend to the impossible. The omnipotence is the power to do everything possible, but nothing impossible. Now, it is impossible to make the past into the future. It is impossible to change the past. God cannot change the past. There are many other things that God cannot do. Anything that you and I can think of as impossible is beyond God's power to do. That's the answer to your first question. The second question is, where does God come from? God is an eternal being and does not come into being or pass away. God is in the eternal present, has no beginning and no end, and no change.
Well, then I'd like to ask a final question. In the Christian...
Mr. Sagan may be a good cosmologist, but he's not a theologian at all, I'm sorry to say.
What do you have in for Carl Sagan?
I just think he's a... I mean, he's a nice fellow, but I think overdoes.
But where does he commit a basic philosophical mistake?
No, his only mistake is trying to be philosophical. he's a fine scientist, but he often does what scientists do, think that their scientific eminence or their scientific status justifies them in thinking that they are competent philosophical thinkers.
But where does he verge on philosophical territory?
Oh, in those lectures in Cosmos, he makes all kinds of philosophical remarks.
Uh-huh.
Could I ask my last question?
Yeah, go ahead, sir.
The last question is, in the Christian theology, they tried, many Christian religions take the position that Jesus Christ is God.
Christ is not God. Jesus Christ is the second person of the Trinity. The mystery of the Trinity is that God the Father is God, God the Son is God, and God the Holy Spirit is God, but God the Father is not God the Son is not God the Holy Spirit. The mystery of the Trinity is very difficult to fathom. So when you say Jesus Christ is God, you've got to be sure you're saying the Son is God, as well as the Father is God, but the Son is not the Father, and the Father is not the Son.
Well, if I may just go at this a little further, they use an explanation based on the idea of a hypostatic union. It's a technical word, but it somehow explains that God or Jesus Christ can be both human and divine at the same time.
That's the problem of the incarnation, not the Trinity. Jesus Christ is one substance of two natures, not two substances. One substance of it's a mystery. I mean that both God and man in one being. The great mysteries of the Church, of the Christian Church, are the mystery of the Incarnation, the mystery of the Trinity, and the mystery of the Eucharist.
Those don't fall into the category of logical impossibility?
Oh, no. They're not impossible. They're beyond our power to comprehend thoroughly.
They are on first scrutiny paradoxical.
They're paradoxical, yes.
But but not impossible.
Not impossible, no.
Thank you very much.
We thank you for the call, sir. 591-7200 is the number. 312, the area code for long-distance calls. And you are on the air. Good evening.
Good evening. I was fascinated by your discussion. As I understood, the difference between man and brute was the ability to conceptualize, and then as the discussion progressed, the discussion of how the human child learns language, and then at one point learns to conceptualize.
Let me give you an example. A child first learns to say mama and daddy and nursey and doggy, all perceptual objects. And then suddenly the child, by that simple, because the word is applied to the thing which is right there, and almost if you put the label on the thing. The child hears the word kindergarten and says to mommy, tell me, what is a kindergarten? And the mother says, a kindergarten is a place where children like you go to play. Now, the child learns the meaning of kindergarten without any object present. I mean, okay. He's not at a kindergarten. But, in other words, the child can learn the meaning of a word by relating it to the meaning of other words. No okay. animal learns any language that way. Every element in the vocabulary, if a chimpanzee has 136 words, say 136 signs it can use, each one is separate. It doesn't, no one of those signs gets its meaning from the combination of other signs. Each sign has its meaning from the object to which it applies. But the child learns kindergarten, not by applying the word kindergarten to a present kindergarten, which the child has never seen, but he knows what the word children means, he knows what the word play means, he knows what the word go means, he knows what the word place means. So the mother says, a kindergarten is a place where children like you go to play. And that gives the word kindergarten a conceptual meaning.
Okay.
And no animal can learn language that way.
But, Mortimer, you do remember, whether you think the research is valid or not, that in the work with Washoe, the original signing chimp, and various others, they have reported syntactic combinations which were inventive and which were a kind of conceptualization.
No, but not. But the vocabulary contains no words which derive their meaning from other words.
Okay, well, I did understand, and I'm glad you clarified it for me, but my question came, I recently read some accounts, I don't know if they're apocryphal or not, so of human children who had been deprived of human contact.
Yep.
For their formative years.
Oh, they can be reduced to the brutal condition of
right.
deprivation. Sensory deprivation will make idiots of them.
Right. But were later able to learn to communicate in language, but not to conceptualize, as I understood the account.
I don't know the evidence you're talking about.
We have the record of many cases of so-called feral children, beginning with the wild boy of Averon, the famous case of Caspar Hauser, and others that have been studied in more recent years. Kids raised either by animals or more commonly in utter isolation because crazy parents threw the kid in a closet for the first 15 years.
It's hard to get them up to the human level, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, well, though claims have been made that some have been brought to the human level.
Raise the question in my mind, is there a window, as they say in space talk and that, during which this human quality can develop, and yet can it be
That's
missed?
A very good question. It's a good question, I have to say quite honestly. I don't know the answer to it, but it's a very good question. I should like to think about it. I don't know the answer.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Well, there is a kind of window of great achievement or of vulnerability, and it's really the first year.
Yeah. Oh, yes, no question about
it. If in the first year there is simply deprivation of close supportive relationship with a caring adult, everything goes wrong from there on.
Absolutely. And by the way, the most important thing we've learned is you must get that the activity, keeping that child sensitized and active, stimulated from the moment of birth on. The more stimulation, the better. That brain growth that follows is utterly crucial.
And we know as well that they seek from very early on stimulation.
Yes.
The human infant is very active in exploration and intrusion.
Just think of the importance of making them crawl.
Yeah. But then we know the same is true of frolicsome little bear cubs.
Sure. Has to do with the myelinization of the nervous system.
It does, in fact. And that's a structural basis.
Right.
That's a necessary
absolutely
and largely sufficient condition for
that kind of thing.
Emergence of curiosity.
Right.
591-7200, that's where you reach us, and you have done so. Good evening. Hello, are you there?
Hello? I can hear you very vaguely.
Well, I can hear you clearly, ma'am. Why don't you proceed?
All right. I would like to know Dr. Adler's thoughts of the idea of reincarnation as growth of soul.
Did you say reincarnation?
Yes.
That, by the way, is a Hindu doctrine, as you know.
Yes.
And it's one that Plato adopted also. One of the extraordinary things about Plato is that in one of the dialogues, he has the myth of the soul's reincarnation in other forms. And very much like the Eastern doctrine, the soul inhabits an animal body as a kind of punishment for having misbehaved in this life.
By the way, incidental, but isn't it... Hold on 1 minute, ma'am. Isn't it the case, hasn't there been some attempt to check this historically, that those doctrines literally reached Plato from the East?
No question about it.
There was Indian influence on Greek thought.
Right. No. That is the case. Go ahead, ma'am.
I wasn't thinking of it as reincarnation to animal body, but simply growth of, you know, reaching karma, that sort of idea. And also in terms of... Aquinas, what made me think of this was when you said that Aquinas was able to reconcile the idea of soul with resurrection.
The resurrection,
of the body.
Not reincarnation, resurrection of the body.
Well, if you are reincarnated in many bodies.
No. By the way, St. Thomas definitely rejects the notion of reincarnation. There's no reincarnation at all in Christian religion. There's resurrection of the body you have. And let me, while you're on the phone, let me explain that, because I use that phrase. You do understand that the body that is resurrected is not your body in this life. It is one of the most difficult phrases, a spiritual body. It's the kind of body that Christ had after he came back to earth. Able to go through doors without opening them, you see. A very special kind of body.
Thank you very much.
We thank you, ma'am. And on to the next caller. Good evening.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I'm assuming, Mr. Adler, you don't have any problem with the theory of evolution.
Not at all.
Looking at it from my standpoint...
I'm an evolutionist.
Okay, looking at it from my standpoint, it would seem that obviously human beings have evolved from animals.
There's no question that the human body is a mammalian primate body.
And I would, you know, obviously go further and say that the human brain... Or even human mind evolved out of...
Yes, but now, one thing, I have to stop at that point. If I'm correct in my view that the human intellect is not identical with the human brain, but exceeds the power of the brain, though it needs the power of the brain as a necessary condition, then at this point, evolution fails to explain the origin of man.
You mean man's brain?
No, man's mind.
Man's mind. Well, I think that it can be explained by the...
Well, only if you're a materialist.
Well, I don't necessarily mean that that's the same thing as the human brain.
No, but...
The one may have evolved out of the other.
Look, in terms of what we said this evening on our discussion, Milton and I, if the materialist is right that the brain is both the necessary and sufficient condition for conceptual thought, then there's no qualification about the evolution of man from apes.
But here's a curious thing, then, staying with this. The call has raised the most interesting question. We know that the Earth is 4.5 to 5 billion years old. We know that organic life first began a billion and a half to 2 billion years ago.
That Homo sapiens is 35,000.
And that our brand of man, Homo sapiens sapiens, is 35 to 50,000 years old.
That, yes.
That earlier forms of man...
Hominids.
But Neanderthal is possibly 100,000 years old. Since man evolved along that phylogenetic line and emerges, let's say, merely 100,000 years ago, though pre-sapient forms of man are as much as half a billion years old, possibly, but all of that needn't detain us at the moment. The question that I would raise is, did God or whomever or whatever wait until we had evolved to that level before adding on that extra quality which is unique to man?
The answer to that question, as I understand it, is yes.
Period.
That with the evolution of the human body, the very special body that man has, I mean, it has very special things. For example, no other hominid form has... the kind of fully erect posture and the flat face. All the other hominids have sloping faces. The flat face, I mean, there are very curious bodily distinctions about the human body. When the human body first emerged with Homo sapiens, then according to the theologians, who hold that man has the spiritual element, at that point, God infused a rational soul in that body.
At that point, God, looking down, saw that Homo sapiens was good.
He's good. And ready for it.
And ready for it. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I'd like to make a point there that sometimes that's used as the mysterious intervention there at the evolution of the human mind and the human brain. And I would like to quote my friend Stephen Jay Gould,
mm-hmm.
who would make the comment that the brain merely evolved simply as an adaptive response to an ecological selection pressure in a peripherally isolated allopatric population.
I have no difficulty about the evolution of the human brain at all.
I know, but I would carry that further into William James or Bertrand Russell's view of neutral monism and think of terms of space-time continuum, the evolution of the human mind.
But that's where I'm differing with you, you see. I'm saying there's no difficulty about the evolution.
But this is a naturalistic explanation.
I understand.
You're intervening something which you can't account for.
You have to look at other aspects of the argument. If I am right that the human being has powers that no ape has and no other hominid has, but only Homo sapiens has,
well, you'll grant that Neanderthal might have had it.
Well,
you have to be sapiens.
It would still be a matter of degree.
No. I'm saying it's not a matter of degree. I'm saying this is a matter of kind.
We know that Neanderthal had a larger brain case than Homo sapiens, and possibly was just as bright. Can't we then assume?
No evidence in terms of the surrounding artifacts.
Merely that it evolved from something that's a different kind doesn't mean it didn't evolve from something that's a different degree.
I know that. I'm saying evolution can't answer the question. Right now, you see, what we have to say is right now, the difference between existing man and existing other primate forms is a difference in kind, not in degree.
Closed and open programs.
Well, you say it that way. I can say it my way, which says that...
You've got angels.
No. I've got lots of evidence that the only kind of thinking that the present apes can do is perceptual, not conceptual. I'm sorry. No ape has given me any...
It doesn't have to. It evolved from that.
What I'm trying to say is if right now there's a difference in kind between man and ape, as I think there is, then man cannot have evolved from ape in the way in which evolution prescribes.
I see that's the only way you can see it, if one is honest.
I
don't think honesty is an issue, but there are different traditions here. I'm curious about yours, if I may ask, sir. From what do you draw? What's your profession?
My profession?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I cut hair.
And by the way, Stephen Gould's a very good writer, by the way. I like him very much.
Yeah, he was here recently. Well, I thank you very much for an interesting call, sir.
Okay.
It's time for me to spring my last surprise, though it's not a surprise to you. One other line of argument that could be used against you is, man is not that unique. He is not the only creature who possesses the ability to conceptualize, imagine, and solve problems from a distance, so to speak. Man himself has now created a creature that essentially mocks or models man, and that is the computer, or beyond mere computers, the artificial intelligence programs that have now been built into computers and which are open-circuited so that they can go on learning and ascending to ever higher levels in problem formulation as well as problem solution. Therefore, the computer and what we can now do with it and what on a projective basis we might expect it to be able to do in the form of high intellective functions is another being of a sort who does what man can do.
You have stated the most important, the crucial, critical test for the difference, for which of the two hypotheses is correct, the identity hypothesis or the Aristotelian hypothesis. The Aristotelian hypothesis says, no, the computer can't think.
Well, Aristotle didn't know about computers.
I'm speaking for Aristotle now. As an Aristotelian, I say that matter cannot think and never will think. The computer, in the first place, made by man, is programmed by man.
And but is now programmed to develop its own additional programs.
But any program that provides for additional program is limited programming. Man is unprogrammed. My whole point of the most important thing about man is that he's unprogrammed. Or he has, there may be 13 or 11 congenital reflexes, or reflexes that develop within the first 150 days of the life, and most of them disappear except for the patella and the papillary. Other than those reflexes, man has no programming at all. The remarkable thing about human nature is his unprogrammed character. Now, you know about Turing and the Turing test. I'm willing to submit to the evidence. When a Turing machine is built...
Explain what the Turing test is.
The Turing test operates as follows. This great mad mathematician, the extraordinary man who really solved the Enigma puzzle and was part of the salvation of the British Empire in the Second World War, said, if you put a man and a woman behind a screen and have an interrogator in front of the screen, and the interrogation proceeds by the passage of written messages, so there's no tone of voice, and the man and woman are instructed to try to deceive the interrogator. He is trying to find out by questioning them if he can tell which is a man and which is a woman behind the screen. Their aim is to so answer the questions that they deceive him. According to Turing, it can be done. The interrogator can guess 50-50, but it's not better than 50-50, and that shows that they have escaped detection, because his judgment is no better than the guess. Now, says Turing, put behind the screen, in place of a man and a woman, a human being, male or female, and a computer, a program computer. Turing very sharply adds, a computer with only infant programming, so that it has to learn. It's, no matter how well that infant programming is given to it, its limit of learning is very sharp. So that the conversational test, this is what it is, if it carried on long enough, the interrogator will be able to detect the failure of the computer to deceive. Because the infinite flexibility of human conversation, the range of questions, unpredictable questions, that no program or even program learning on the part of the computer could meet, that human intellect is able to have, the human being will be differentiated from the computer by its adaptability to that question.
But we now know that there are already many areas in which the computer would pass the Turing test.
For a very short time.
For example, if I am the judge and we limit all communications to an exchange of chess moves, and I'm playing on two boards against two other hidden chess players, one is a computer and one is a man, even a chess master, I will have no way of better than a 50-50 probability of drawing that distinction.
But that chess...
It's merely chess.
The Turing test is conversational. The interesting thing about the Turing test is that Turing didn't know this. This was the Cartesian challenge. Descartes, who insisted matter could not think, and at that point I'm agreeing with Descartes, said, build me a machine that can engage in conversation with the flexibility and the infinite unpredictability of human conversation, and I will admit that matter can think.
All right, but computers are at the most only 30 years old, the analytic engine was built in...
I'm now going to make my point. Uh-huh. I'm willing to wait 500 years, 1,000. I'm willing to have the experiment tried again and again and again. All I say is that if at the end of that 1,000 years, the computer still can't pass the Turing test, every time they try and fail, my side of the issue gets stronger and stronger and stronger.
Yeah,
I'm submitting myself to the test. If 1,000 years from now the Turing machine really passes the test, then Aristotle is wrong, and the materialist is right. In other words, I'm not judging the question. I'm saying we really now have. I think the Turing invention is a marvelous one because it's an absolutely critical test. If the machine can engage in human conversation as flexibly as human beings can, it's just like exactly like a human being.
If
that's the case, since we know it's only matter, there's nothing immaterial about the machine, we know that matter can think.
When the extraterrestrial vehicle finally lands and the man comes and the entity comes out and says, take me to your leader or take me to your computer, and passes the Turing test when we submit him to that, that's of no relevance at all to this basic issue. That's just man-like intelligence elsewhere in the universe.
That's right. That's all that is.
And you rather expect that to be the case, don't you?
Don't worry at all about that.
Yeah. This is WGN, Clear Channel Radio from Chicago. We'll return directly to Mortimer Adler and to your questions for him after these words.
Extension 720. Again, your host, Milt Rosenberg. Note.
Thank you very much, Jack. The new book by Mortimer J. Adler is to be officially published tomorrow, though I've got a copy of it in front of me at this moment. The Angels and Us. The publishers are Macmillan, and I have to testify yet once again. It's always amazing to me how you can take on the most difficult issues, issues basic in philosophy and theology, and yet make them really sing and zing for the ordinary intelligent lay reader. It's a talent which could not have come easily. This is, what, your 28th, your 30th book?
28th.
28th book.
And I would say that I've only managed to do that in the last five books I've written. I began to do it by writing that autobiography, The
Philosopher at Large.
Then the next four books, Aristotle for Everybody, How to Think About God, Six Great Ideas, in this book, written in that style.
Gee, Mortimer, we got together at just the right time, because the first book you came to talk with us about was Philosopher at Large, and then all those that have been published since.
That's right.
But I disagree with your own estimate of yourself. I know a number of your earlier books, and they are eminently lucid.
But they're not as easily to read. I mean, in the days before Philosopher at Large, I put lengthy footnotes and very long scholarly notes. I was trying to do something which I think is impossible to deal with two audiences at once, my scholarly friends, my philosophical colleagues, and satisfy them that I had a full grasp of the literature and dealt with their technical arguments, and at the same time, talk to the common man. I've given up the professors entirely. I don't care a rap about the academic audience.
Don't you occasionally indulge yourself in a technical article for a philosophical journal?
Never.
Not anymore?
No.
Yeah. I think it's a wise choice.
I think so, too.
591-7200 is our number, and we'll get right back to the callers. Good evening.
Yes, I started with a single question, and it's generated kind of a multiple question as the discussion continues.
You must discipline yourself.
All right.
One question, one question at a time. I'll answer three if you'll ask one at a time.
All right. Essentially, the first thing is, in response to intellect amongst the lower orders, is it not possible that it simply are inadequate communication? Inadequate understanding, which does not allow us to understand the concepts within the language of the animals themselves.
No.
And not the translation to our understanding.
No, I would say this is all to be judged in terms of their behavioral manifestations. The behavioral manifestations of animals reveals nothing but perceptual thought. Perceptual thought. There is no indication in anything that animals do of conceptual thought. That's just behavioral. Now, they may do conceptual thinking, keep it to themselves in such a way that we can't detect it. I can't say that. I mean, it's perfectly possible they're trying to deceive us, but I don't believe that makes any sense.
But there's no way of knowing whether there's an Einstein or a Turing under the sea in one of the great herds of porpoises. They live in so different an environment that there can be no physical record of great achievements. There may be significant thought and beautiful artistic imagery. We do seem to know, or at least people like Libby and others have suggested, they've got a rich and full linguistic system and are in communication with one another, but we don't know how to read the language.
All I can say is that may be the case, but there's no way of finding out.
But then there was a second question generated, in fact, by something Dr. Rosenberg had said.
Yep.
Essentially, why haven't you more deeply investigated the Easter? I know in one television program I'd seen you said in part it was a matter of time. But, like, for instance, there's an adequate understanding, the explanation Dr. Rosenberg, for instance, gave of reincarnation. By Hinayana doctrine or by Dravidic Hindu doctrine is not correct. He's talking about a Western concept, transmigration, whereas in actuality, reincarnation would be more likened to a flower existing in the spring, then dying in the next spring.
Mm-hmm.
Another flower exists.
Mm-hmm.
The causal relationship between those two is more a relationship of concept than it is of actual individuality. And it is within this concept being universally applied that there is, so to speak, an eternal sequence of souls, although even sequence is an incorrect word to use.
I mean, I can't say no to that with any assurance, but I have no evidence that it's true.
Well, a proper distinction you could make is the one that you make throughout this book, that there are two levels of two realms of discourse, the religious and the philosophical. And these, as the caller gives them to us, are religious ideas,
surely,
worth as much as religious ideas are worth, but not to be judged by philosophical
methods. There's no philosophical basis for thinking that at all.
We'll thank the caller, and we should dash on and take care of as many others as possible. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello. I have a question for Professor Rosenberg. It's about Aristotle's theory of mind, and so it strikes me that that theory can sort of be divided into two parts. One part which falls naturally onto the materialist side, and the other part that falls into the anti-materialist side, as he called it. Now, on the one hand, Aristotle says things like the soul or the mind is the form of the individual. Now, I can see that a reasonable materialist would very gladly accept that, be able to accept that part of it. On the other side is the side of Aristotle that was emphasized here, in that the intellect part of the mind is supposed to be immaterial.
Right.
Now, I don't see how that would differ or evade the problems that you spoke of with reference to Plato or Descartes. I mean, they spoke of the whole soul as being just sort of an object somehow in the body, a pilot in the ship.
Yep.
And now you seem to be saying Aristotle is just saying a part of the intellect, or maybe a part of the soul.
No, not a part of the soul, not a part of the intellect. The intellectual part of the soul is the one part that's immaterial.
Okay, but how does that? The intellectual part of the soul is the one.
The
part
soul
of
as a whole is the substantial form of an organic body having the potentiality of life, and what Aristotle is saying is an animal soul is completely immersed in the matter of the animal body, a plant soul is completely immersed. It's as if the rational soul is 5/6 immersed in the matter of the body, and 1/6 sticks up.
Right.
I can't say the other way. It's not completely immersed. A little bit of the soul rises above matter. That's the intellect.
Right. So the sticky part for Descartes and Plato, as I understand it, is trying to describe actually what the relationship is between the immaterial part.
You're quite right. They can't possibly do it.
But how does Aristotle get around that part?
Because the soul as a whole is the form of the body, is the form of an organic body.
Yeah, but what about that part of the soul which is immaterial?
No, but you see, the soul still remains. That's why the connection's rational and clear. The whole soul, the rational soul of a man, is the form that the matter of a human body takes. But nevertheless, even though that the relation of soul to body is form to matter, in the case of man, the form in one part exceeds the matter. I have to say it that way. That's a much more intelligible relationship than the pilot and the ship, which gives you two substances. How is Socrates one? How is Socrates one being if he's really two beings, a pilot and a ship? Either one can get along without the other.
Okay. In that case, perhaps the question I have could be transferred between that part of the soul, the form of the body, which is material, and that part which is immaterial. Yeah,
right.
What is the relationship between those two parts?
The soul gives the body its vital powers. The human soul gives the human body five vital powers that are organic in character and material. But one of the powers that the human soul confers upon the human being is an immaterial power. That's the intellectual power. In other words, it's a distinction of powers, not of substances. Man has five material powers and one immaterial power.
And for further explication, I recommend a close reading of The Angels and Us by Mortimer J. Adler. I fear I must dash rather quickly to work in a few more callers, and here is the next. Good evening.
Good evening, Dr. Rosenberg and Dr. Adler.
Yes, indeed.
Well, I'd like to ask Dr. Adler why it's not possible that at the moment of death, time is no more, and instead of the soul being in a holding pattern, why isn't the past, present, and future all present to the soul at the same time, just as it is to God? And why isn't the final judgment at that very moment for that soul, for all souls at the moment of death? Do you have any thoughts on that idea?
Well, it is usually said by theologians that only God is outside of time, is eternal.
Mm-hmm.
The soul, while it was in its bodily existence, as the form of the human body, was went through all kinds of mutations and changes, and it carries, again, the I'm speaking as a theologian now, not as a philosopher. I can't say this as a philosopher. It carries into its separate existence when it subsists apart from the body with God's help. All it has is the memories from its past. It has no present function because we learn from... our intellects don't operate without sense experience. Mm-hmm. We don't have... See, Descartes made the error of thinking we had innate ideas. Only angels have innate ideas. We don't have innate ideas. All of our ideas, our most remote concepts, are built out of sense experience somehow.
Doesn't time get a little messed up in the innards of a modern cyclotron some of the time? Haven't there been some findings in recent particle physics indicating that the linearity of time gets disrupted?
I don't know the answer to that question. But in any case, I don't think that's the answer to the question our interrogator is asking us.
No, but it relates to your assertion that only God is
eternal.
Is eternal and outside of time.
Non-temporal, yes.
Yeah.
You don't think time is just connected with the body. It's also connected with the soul?
Well, let me talk about the angels for a moment. God is eternal. All corporeal things are temporal. And the angels occupy a middle position between the eternal and the temporal. And the theologian says they eve-eternal, mm-hmm. which is not quite eternal and not quite temporal.
How does an angel get to be an angel?
Only by creation. All the angels that ever existed at the moment of creation. Saint Augustine's, the most remarkable thing Augustine did was to interpret the first sentence of Genesis, which says, "In the beginning, God created heaven and earth." Heaven stands for the whole order of angels. Earth for all corporeal things. In the beginning, God created the spiritual universe and the corporeal universe. And the angels that then existed are the only angels that ever exist. No new angels come into existence.
All right. Thanks, Dr. Adler.
Thank you for the call, ma'am.
Good evening.
And another caller. Good evening.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, my question is, why can't you prove the existence of an angel from the existence of God? Namely, that in the Bible, the angels all serve as agents of God. And Dr. Adler says that God cannot do the impossible, so that means that God must work through forces. And if you define an angel as a force, why can you not say then...
Well, that's not a proof, you see. That is correct. As a matter of faith, based upon scriptural passages, the angels appear to be God's messengers.
It's theology, but not philosophy.
It's an article of faith.
Yeah.
Now, the reason why you can't prove philosophically the existence of angels is a very simple one. To prove the existence of any hypothetical possible being, you must show that it is necessary to posit its real existence to explain some given phenomenon. Now, the existence of angels in philosophy explains nothing. You don't have to posit the existence of angels to explain anything you know.
But how does God accomplish his...
Oh, that's scripture. That's faith, not philosophy.
No, no. Well, but you said you were convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that God exists.
That's right, I am.
You have to account for how God accomplishes whatever he does.
Well,
how do you account for what God does?
God, within the philosophical thing, there is no ground in a philosophical conception of God, not without any reference to scripture now, for God's creation and employment of angels as messengers.
But how does he accomplish his ends in your own mind? If he exists, which you say you believe beyond a reasonable doubt, how does God accomplish whatever he accomplishes?
By his will.
But what is his will? How does his will act? Does he have to have forces?
He does not. There's no philosophical reason. There's a theological reason.
Our caller assumes the necessity for God to have agents.
But not necessary at all.
Yeah. And that would be the role of angels.
Sure, yes. Yeah. But not necessary. Not philosophically necessary.
Surely not, if God is infinitely powerful.
The only grounds for the belief in angels is scriptural texts that show that they exist.
Sir, I thank you for the call. Mortimer, your book is full of apposite and really quite beautiful quotations. One of them is from a famous soliloquy of Hamlet's. I want to read just the brief excerpt, because it then leads me to something I want to get you talking on. Hamlet says, "What a piece of work is a man, how noble in reason, how infinite in faculty, in form, and moving, how express and admirable in action, in apprehension, how like an angel, how like a god. the beauty of the world, the paragon of animals. And that's the 1/6, which is of spirit and is true mind.
Right.
Yet, how dismal is our state now, and though we've achieved so much, how desperate is our condition. I remind you that a few months ago, around the turn of the year, we did a program where we called out and talked to some 10 old friends, and you were one of the first we talked to. And I asked you what really has been preoccupying you this year, and you talked about the possible coming demise of the world in a nuclear holocaust. I then went on to talk to all sorts of other people, eminent men and women of one sort or another, and all but one of them, when I put that question, said exactly the same thing. At this moment, we are so aware of something evil, something stupid, something self-destructive in our nature. And it's interesting to note that you could not find, you find no evidence of any similar will towards self-immolation in any of the other animal species. Right. We may be far superior even to our primate evolutionary cousins, but we are also far more self-injurious and, in a way, more visibly mad. How do you reconcile that with the superior and qualitatively distinctive nature of man in the animal kingdom?
At the end of the second book of the second chapter of the first book of the Politics, Aristotle says, man, in the context of law and justice, is the best of animals. Separated from law and justice, the worst of animals. Men are by many ways fiendish. Only a rational animal can be irrational. The non-rational animals are not irrational. Our present handling of the nuclear arms race is utterly irrational. Any rational person thinking reasonably would say, call it all off. Throw them away. We're never going to use them. I would not ask for a complete disarmament. I think you have to have defense forces against aggression. But I think I would go so far on rational grounds, say, I would be willing to advocate unilateral nuclear disarmament. Let Russia waste itself away with the production of non-consumable goods and starve its people by putting all its efforts into guns, not butter. Certainly I would ask for a nuclear freeze, but I'd go further than a nuclear freeze. I think the whole business of maintaining nuclear establishments is wrong. Their very existence is a threat to the future of this planet. Simple reason would recommend. And the only thing you can explain it is that people are, this lovely rational animal is capable of being the most irrational of brutes.
So it's the other 5/6 that
That's right.
despoils
That's right.
what the remainder, the remaining 1/6 is capable of.
As Pascal says, it is a pity that he who would act the angel acts the brute.
And in that there's a touch of Greek wisdom
yes.
about pride reaching too far.
That's right.
And
That's
thus right. bringing us to the ultimate mm-hmm. fall.
So.
Time is up. It's
very
been, as ever, utterly fascinating, and I continue to marvel at your ability to take difficult ideas and make them, if not easy, at least workable and capable of close examination without cheapening them. That is a very great gift that you bring to us, and
Thank
I'm
you
very,
very
grateful to you for having joined us again. And we've got a new book coming in September.
Yes, but let's not mention it yet.
I won't give its name, but you understand that you are required to come and talk about
it. I most definitely will. We'll need more than an hour, 2 hours.
Well, then we'll do another program like we did last time, two
right.
nights in a row.
Right.
With that, we are just about out of time.